Okay, we start. Okay, today is June 5th, 2010. And we're doing the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, Part 4. I will begin with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning everyone. Okay, we are still in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, and now we're at page 262. And last time we ended the section number 21. And at this point, the Buddha makes the decision he accepts the request of Brahma Sahampati, to teach the Dhamma. And so he declares, open for them are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears now show their faith. So now the Buddha has made this commitment to begin teaching. Then Brahma, after receiving this assurance from the Buddha, then Brahma disappears. Okay, so now we're beginning paragraph 22. And so now the Buddha comes to the, now that he's made the decision to start teaching, he faces the question, to whom should I first teach the Dhamma? And then this is followed by the other question, next question, who will understand this Dhamma quickly? See, Buddha is very modern, he wants quick results. Okay, and so in a way this is going to be a momentous historical event that's lying just ahead. But now the Buddha is the one who's reached the supreme enlightenment, and he's recognized that other people, other beings have this capacity for enlightenment. They're like lotus flowers in different stages of growth. And there are some lotus flowers that are just on the surface of the water, just waiting for the sun to rise, to shed its light. And when the light hits the lotus flowers blossom. And so the Buddha wants to find those people or beings who are like lotus flowers on the surface of the water, just ready to blossom, who will be able to understand the Dhamma quickly. This would be people who say in past lives have done meritorious deeds, and to have cultivated quite vigorously in this life, so they already have very strong faculties of energy, samadhi, concentration, and this urge to understand the truth and to gain liberation. Okay, so then, as soon as that question comes into the Buddha's mind, then the sort of thought occurs to him, Alara Kalama is wise, intelligent, and discerning. He has long had a little dust in their eyes. Okay, so this is like a very key phrase, having a little dust in one's eyes. This goes back actually to the time when the Buddha was surveying the world with the eye of the Buddha. Just a few paragraph up, we see that the Buddha said, after surveying the world with the eye of the Buddha, he says, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes. Okay, so Alara Kalama is one who has long had little dust in his eyes. Then he thinks, suppose I taught the Dhamma first to Alara Kalama, he will understand it quickly. Okay, now what is being conveyed in this passage? As I said last week, usually if we look deeply into the suttas, we can see that some kind of message is being conveyed. And so the way I see it, there's a certain message being conveyed in this passage right here. Not simply the words on the surface, but something else is underlying this. What might it be? Any ideas?
Then you want to show gratitude.
Exactly. Yeah, he wants to show gratitude because Alara, who was Alara Kalama? His first meditation teacher. And so he wants to repay, he calls us, the debt of gratitude. And so he thinks, let me go to my first teacher and share the Dhamma with him. Okay, so then when this thought comes to his mind, then deities approach him and say, Venerable Sir, Bhante, Alara Kalama died 7 days ago. And then within his own mind, the knowledge arises that Alara Kalama died 7 days ago. So then he thinks that Alara Kalama has lost a great, potentially a great benefit. If he had heard the Dhamma, he would have understood it quickly. So then he thinks, he again considers, to whom should I teach the Dhamma? And then who should he think of but Uddaka Ramaputta? And who is Uddaka Ramaputta? You remember?
His second teacher.
It was the second meditation teacher. Okay, so then he thinks, okay, let me teach the Dhamma to Uddaka Ramaputta, he will understand it quickly. But then when that thought comes to him, then the text says, deities approached me and said, Venerable Sir, Uddaka Ramaputta died last night. And then the knowledge and vision arose in me, Uddaka Ramaputta died last night. And then the same thing, that Uddaka Ramaputta missed out on a great benefit. Doesn't it seem a little peculiar that, you know, he's been practicing meditation in the forest for 6 years? 7 years? 6 years? And, you know, all of this time, these two teachers are alive, and suddenly, actually, he would have reached his enlightenment, according to some texts, 7 weeks earlier, according to other texts, 4 weeks earlier. So at the time he reached enlightenment, his teachers were still alive. If he had gone to teach them immediately after, he could have met them. It's a bit peculiar, I have to say, that one teacher dies 2 weeks earlier and the other teacher dies just the night before. A little bit of a suspicious coincidence. Any significance in that? Of course, it could simply be historical fact. Yeah.
What confuses me is that even though they might have died, I remain in existence.
Excuse me?
What confuses me is that even though they might have died,
yeah,
he was still reach them.
Well, actually not. Even though they died, you see, they had each mastered the arupa meditations, the formless meditative attainments. And because of that mastery, they would have been reborn in formless realms. So they have no physical body, no physical sense organs. And so they have no way of... I mean, this is getting a little bit beyond my sphere of competence. But, you know, this and learning to use an iPod are both a little beyond my sphere of competence. But they don't have any sense faculties, any physical body. And so the Buddha can teach the beings in the ordinary Deva worlds, the Brahma worlds, but in the formless worlds, they don't have ears, so they can't hear him. They don't have eyes, they can't see him. He can't see them.
Is it more reason for him to teach because these teachers are gone now?
Maybe. I don't have an answer to this. It just strikes me as puzzling. It could, of course, be simple coincidence, simple historical fact. Or it could be a way maybe of saying, this is just a guess, that like the old dispensations are now passing out. This is the time for the new dispensation to arise.
Would it be Mara's retaliation?
No, it doesn't say anything about Mara causing their death. Okay, anyway, we go back to the text. Okay, so again he's pondering the question, who should I teach first? And now, if you... I think it was mentioned in 36 Sutta that there were the five ascetics who were attending upon the Buddha, thinking that he is the one who's striving most vigorously. And so if anybody is going to reach enlightenment, it's going to be this prince of the Sakyan clan. But then when the Buddha started to take, when he gave up on the extreme ascetic practices and started to take food again and to regain his physical strength, then they became disillusioned with the Buddha. They thought that he had returned to a life of luxury, and so they abandoned him. So now the Buddha occurs to him, the bhikkhus of the group of five who attended upon me while I was engaged in my striving were very helpful. So again, now it's that thought of, you see, the thought of gratitude is coming up. Suppose I teach the Dhamma first to them. Okay, so then he makes that decision. And maybe you're expecting deities came to me and told me the bhikkhus of the group of five were killed in an automobile accident this morning. But not like that. He finds with his divine eye, he sees that these five ascetics are now living near Benares in the deer park at Isipatana. This is a place, today it's called Sarnath. Okay, so now the Buddha, perhaps he spends a little more time around the Bodhi tree at Uruvela. And then it says that he sets out to wander by stages to Benares. And so now he's walking between Bodh Gaya and Benares. think I once looked it on the map to see how what the distance is. I think it's about 200 miles. So if one walks 20 miles a day, one could do it in 10 days. If one goes at a more leisurely pace, maybe 15 days. Well, you have to remember the Buddhist tradition places the day of the Buddha's enlightenment on the full moon of the month Vaisakha, which is on our calendar, it's about the full moon of May. And they put the date of the first discourse, the full moon of July. So that's 2 months. If the Buddha spent 7 weeks around the Bodhi tree, then he has 1 week to get to Benares. So he should be walking, if it's 200 miles, about 25 to 30 miles a day. Okay, so now as he's walking along this trail to Benares, he comes across an ascetic called Upaka. His name is Upaka, who belongs to a sect called the Ajivakas. The Ajivakas were a school of ascetics that existed contemporaneously with Buddhism. And they actually continue to exist in India, I think based in South India, up to a pretty late period, I think the 14th century of the Common Era. And this was a sect founded by one of the rival teachers of the Buddha, whose name was Makkali Gosala. And this sect was closely related to the Jains. The founder of the Jains, Mahavira, and the founder of the Ajivakas, Makkali Gosala, before their respective enlightenments, had been friends who had been practicing, striving together. And then they had some quarrel and they went their separate ways. And then each founded a school, a religious school, which each of those schools continued in India, perhaps even longer than Buddhism did. Okay, so Upaka sees the Buddha on the road and says, "Your faculties are clear, the color of your skin is pure and bright." So he sees that the Buddha, as he's walking along, is very serene. Probably his skin has a bright glow to it, because it's still sort of basking in the afterglow of his enlightenment experience. And then he asks him, "Under whom have you gone forth, friend? Who is your teacher? And whose Dhamma do you proclaim?" Like, this was the standard question that ascetics would ask one another when they would meet out on the open road in India. They would always assume that the person they're meeting was a student of another teacher. And especially now, according to the canon, the Buddha at this time is just 35 years old. Let's see, Evan, how old are you? You're about 39?
38.
Okay, suppose 3 years ago I met you. You're 35 years old and you're the fully enlightened Buddha. And I say, you know, from my perspective, it's a kid, young man. And he says, "I'm the Buddha." No, I say, "Who's your teacher?" He says, "I have no teacher, I'm the Buddha." So I can't believe it, right? So Upaka, he assumes, he sees this relatively young man, 35 years old, walking along. And so he assumes that he's still a student under the guidance of a teacher. So he asks him, "Who is your teacher?" And then the Buddha replies to him, probably whether the Buddha actually replied in verse, that I don't know. It could be that the Buddha gave a prose statement, and then the compilers of the canon, in order to give more oomph to the statement, to give it more, make it more impressive, they versified it. Okay, and so the Buddha speaks, if it was an ordinary person speaking, it would sound rather boastful or pompous, but this is one who's completely free from any kind of inner sense of self. So from his perspective, he's just really describing his own situation objectively. So he says, I am one who has transcended all, a knower of all, unsullied or unstained among all dhammas, all things, renouncing all, by cravings ceasing, I am freed, having known this all for myself, to whom should I point as a teacher? I have no teacher, and one like me exists nowhere in all the world. First glance, it really seems like boastful to be saying, making statements like that at a superficial level. So, one like me exists nowhere in all the world with all its gods, because I have no person for my counterpart. I am the accomplished one. This is the arahat in the world. I am the teacher supreme. I alone am a Sammasambuddha, a fully enlightened one, whose fires are quenched and extinguished. I go now to the city of Kasi. Kasi is the state in which Benares was located. So I go now to the city of Kasi to set in motion the Dhamma Chakra, the wheel of Dharma. In a world that has become blind, I go to beat the drum of the deathless. So the Buddha is making these very bold statements, and then when Upaka hears them, he says, by your claims, friend, you ought to be the universal or infinite victor or conqueror. He uses a word, an expression. I think it occurs only in this passage in Pali. Yeah, the word Jina means conqueror. And this was the designation given to the founder of Jainism. In fact, the word Jain means a follower of the Jina, the conqueror. And then Ananta means infinite. So he's saying, by your claims, you should be the infinite conqueror or the conqueror of the infinite. Perhaps he even thought that the Buddha was, he might have thought that the Buddha is Mahavira, the founder of Jainism. And so there were actually these several words sort of floating around in India at the time of the Buddha to designate the fully accomplished person. One word was arahat, another word was Buddha, another word was Jina. And so Buddhism took over the word Buddha, Jainism took over the word Jina, and both systems use the word arahat. So the Jains also go, like one of their salutations, their main salutation, goes something like, Namo Jinanam, Namo Siddhanam, Namo Arahantanam. Homage to the conquerors, homage to the perfected ones, homage to the Arahats. Okay, and Buddhism too, it uses the terminology of, it's a kind of military terminology, the terminology of victor, the victor in battle, the one who has achieved victory in battle. But the Buddhists, they don't use the word, normally they don't use the word Jina for the Buddha. Okay, so when Upaka asked that question, then the Buddha says, the victors are those like me who have won the destruction of the asavas, the taints. I have vanquished all papaka dhammana, all evil states, all bad qualities, all the defilements. Therefore, Upaka, I am the Jina, the victor, the victorious one. Okay, now one would think that with utterances like this, this Upaka would bow down and say, so it is, Lord, I go for refuge to the Buddha and to the Dhamma. At present there's no Sangha. But instead, the Buddha's first experience in teaching is a disappointing one. This ajivaka named Upaka shakes his head and says, may it be so, friend. Then he takes another road and walks off to follow his own destiny. According to the commentary, his destiny actually eventually brought him back to the Buddha. Okay, what happened to Upaka? He left the Buddha, he went off, perhaps again continuing on his own, his meditations, his ascetic practices, until one day he encountered someplace in the woods a beautiful daughter of a hunter. And maybe she came to offer him food, I don't remember the details. But he saw her, and he was taken with her, struck with her, and fell in love with her. And then he gave up his ascetic life, and he told her that he wanted to marry her. She said, if you want to marry me, you have to ask my father. So he went to the father and said, I want to marry your daughter. The father said, are you willing, if you want to marry my daughter, you have to take up the trade of a hunter. And here is a man who's been living an ascetic, nonviolent life. But maybe this is the way the commentary is trying to suggest the intoxicating effect of sensual love. So he says, yes, I will take up the craft of a hunter. The father teaches him how to hunt animals. And then he becomes a hunter. Then in time, his wife gets pregnant, gives birth to a little boy. The little boy starts to grow till he's a few years old. And then one day, the father is taking care of the little boy, and then the mother sees what the father is looking after the boy wrongly. And then the mother starts, his wife starts yelling at him and ridiculing him and teasing him, saying, my husband used to be an ascetic, but he was hit by Cupid's arrow and fell from his lofty life. And now he doesn't even know how to take care of his own child. Then he thought, oh my heavens. Instead of like he woke up out of this bad dream and thought, what have I done to myself? I was living a very pure, contemplative life, striving for enlightenment, and here I am married to this terrible woman who's always teasing me, taunting me, yelling at me, living in this household of a hunter, working as a hunter myself. How did I ever fall so low? I have to go back and live the ascetic life. And then he thought, who should I take as my teacher? Then he remembered several years earlier, he had encountered on the road between Gaya and Benares a man who called himself the Infinite Conqueror, and he had been so impressed by this person, so impressed by his statement, he thought, that must be the person who I should take as my teacher. And so then he went walking all over this area in northern India, asking about the person that they call the Conqueror of the Infinite Conqueror, till his inquiries eventually led him back to the Buddha. He met the Buddha, became a monk, and then he became eventually an arahat. And then his wife and child also eventually came to the Buddha, and they became respectively a nun and a monk, and they also achieved enlightenment and became arahats. Okay, so now the Buddha, gradually walking in the direction of Benares, he comes to the deer park, and he's in the distance. The five ascetics are at their headquarters, and in the distance they see the Buddha coming. So the text says, the bhikkhus saw me coming in the distance, and now they make an agreement amongst themselves. They say, here comes the ascetic Gotama, who lives luxuriously, who gave up his striving, his effort, and he returned to a life of luxury. We should not pay homage to him. Earlier, they regarded him as the teacher, and so they would pay homage to him. We should not rise up for him, that's a gesture of politeness, or take his bowl and outer robe. That would be a sign of respect and cordiality. But they say that we can prepare a seat for him, and if he wants to, he can sit down and join us. You know, they'll allow him to join the group, but they no longer want to regard him as their leader or teacher. Okay, and so they prepare the seat for him, but as the Buddha approaches closer, then these monks are not able to keep their pact. So one of them gets up and goes out on the road to meet him, to take his bowl and his extra robe. Another prepares the seat. Another sets out water for him to wash his feet. But they continued to address him by the name, or by the title, Abhuso Gotama. The word Abhuso, it doesn't quite mean friend. It's a term, it's a kind of mixture of respect and friendliness. It's the term that would be used amongst the ascetics, or even between people in society. It's a term which is used between equals. So the word is Abhuso. And then the other word used is Bhante. Okay, so they're addressing him as Abhuso Gotama. And when they address him in that way, then the Buddha says, do not address the Tathagata by name and as friend or ahuso. The Tathagata is an accomplished one, that's an arahat, a fully enlightened one, sammasambuddha. And then he announces his attainment. He says, the deathless has been attained. I shall instruct you, teach you the Dhamma. Practicing as you are instructed, you yourselves will realize here and now through direct knowledge the supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which you have gone forth into homelessness. Okay, so the Buddha is sort of inviting them to partake of the feast, to listen to his teaching, to accept it, and by accepting it, to undertake the practice. And he's assuring them that they could reach the same deathless, the realization of the deathless that he himself has achieved. But the monks won't go in for this, because they're still convinced that the way to enlightenment, the way to liberation, is through the ascetic practices. And so they continue to use the word friend Gotama. They say friend Gotama by the conduct, the practice, the performance of austerities, the self-mortification, the difficult practices that you undertook. You didn't achieve any superhuman states, any of the noble realizations of wisdom. But now look at you. They might be themselves are pretty much reduced to skin and bone. The ribs are showing through their skin. They have that fierce expression in their eyes, the fierce look of the true ascetic. And the Buddha is maybe quite, say, well-fed, a little bit plump, bright, shiny features. And so they're pointing to him and saying, you're now living, look at you, you're living luxuriously, self-indulgent, eating solid meals. We're just eating, you know, just a handful of rice every day. You've given up your fast. We're fasting 2 days a week. You're sleeping on a bed of leaves. We're sleeping on a bed of thorns. So, you've reverted to luxury. So how could you achieve any kind of superhuman state? How could you make this claim? Ridiculous. But now the Buddha tells them, he says, the Tathagata, he's always referring to himself almost from an impersonal point of view, not saying I, but using the expression the Tathagata. The Tathagata does not live luxuriously, nor has he given up his striving and reverted to luxury. Then he repeats the claim that he is now the Arahat, the Buddha, the Enlightened One. I'll teach you the deathless. So this goes on three times through paragraph 27, till now the Buddha takes a different tack. He says to them, bhikkhus, have you ever known me to speak like this before? And when the Buddha raises this question, the monks must have realized that the Buddha was always perfectly straightforward, perfectly sincere. He had the kind of character that would never make any false claims to attainment. And so now they reply to him. They don't say, no, Avuso Gotama, but they say, no hate tongue, I think it's no hate tongue, Bhante, which is now they're changing the address from Avuso to Bhante, which is like Venerable Sir. So they say, no, Venerable Sir. So now the Buddha again repeats his claim that he can teach them the deathless. that they could reach the goal of the spiritual life. And now with this, now when the monks say no, Bhante, that indicates something significant. What does it indicate?
That's the answer, teacher.
Right. Now, just by asking that question, their point of view has changed. Their attitude has completely changed. So it's just indicated very subtly in the text by a change in the form of address. But by using this new address, no Bhante, it shows that now they are looking to him as the teacher. And so he says, I was able to convince the group of five bhikkhus. Okay, then he would go on. Actually, at this point, this text doesn't present it in that way, but if you go to the first discourse of the Buddha, which begins with the Buddha saying to the monks, there are, O monks, these two extremes which should be avoided by one who has gone forth from the world. What are the two? One is the indulgence in a life of sensual pleasures. The other is the practice of self-mortification. So at that point, the Buddha begins his first sermon, the first discourse, turning the wheel of the Dhamma. And then at the end of the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma, or at the end of the first discourse, then one of the five monks named Kandanyo gains the vision of the Dhamma, or the eye of the Dhamma. He sees into the Four Noble Truths, and with that he reaches the first stage of enlightenment. He becomes a Sotapanna. Okay, then after that, the Buddha continues to instruct the group of monks. And so it's really at that point, after the first discourse, that the Buddha and the five monks are now living together for an extended period, and so they have to eat every day, and so they made a kind of agreement. The Buddha stays and teaches, but now since the monks are now his disciples, sometimes three of them will go out on alms round and the Buddha will instruct two. At other times, two will go out on the alms round and bring back the food, and the Buddha will instruct the other three. Okay, and so the six of them would live on the food that was brought back by either three monks or two monks. And this goes on for a period, I believe it's 1 week or 5 days, until at the end of that, first the Buddha gives the discourse on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, that is the turning of the wheel of Dharma. Then somehow, according to the narrative in the text, the second formal discourse that the Buddha gave to all five monks together is the discourse on non-self, that's called the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, which comes in the Samyutta Nikaya. And at the end of the discourse on non-self, all five monks achieve arahatship. But somehow it's said that the Buddha was giving instructions to the monks between the first discourse on the Four Noble Truths, the second discourse on the characteristic of non-self. So what kind of discourses did the Buddha give? What kind of instructions did he give between these two formal discourses? What do you think?
Satipatthana.
Anybody else? But the Satipatthana discourse, it said, was given when the Buddha was living at the Kuru country, which is quite far away from Benares.
I imagine him giving them like short instructions on what to do and how to meditate.
Okay, that's a good idea, yeah. I think probably it was just practical meditation instructions. But I don't think it would be the formal Satipatthana Sutta, but probably just individual meditation instructions, so that they're able to undertake the practice to sort of build up, strengthen their faculties to attain arhatship. Okay, so now at this point where paragraph 30 begins, this will be probably the occasion after the discourse on non-self where they reach arhatship. So now he says, then the bhikkhus of the group of five, thus taught and instructed by me, being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, attain the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Similarly, being subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, they attained the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. The knowledge and vision arose in them. Our deliverance, our liberation is unshakable. This is our last birth. There is no renewal of being, no more continued becoming. Okay, so now at this point the Buddha has completed the narrative of his own search for enlightenment, his attainment of enlightenment, his decision to teach, his first teaching, and the fulfillment of his teaching by liberating the first disciples from birth and death. And now, maybe at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions on anything that we've covered so far. Okay, there's an internet question. Okay, in the canon we find a lot of things which may not be right. Isn't that a violation of one of the most fundamental aspects of right speech? I was wondering how the people following the path could have added such things. I have to say I've wondered about that too, particularly some of the accounts. I mean, what strikes me is some of the way the Buddhist texts report on interactions between the Buddhists and the Jains, where they make the Jains appear foolish, incompetent, deceitful, proud, ambitious, deluded. And I'm sure that from the perspective of the Jains, they were not in such a situation themselves by any means. Okay, I don't know the explanation. Sometimes I guess the feelings of rivalry between sects could motivate people to such an extent that they would misrepresent the positions of others. Okay, any further questions? Yeah, boy. If there is the other microphone.
The first discourse is about the Four Noble Truths,
yeah,
and Noble Eightfold Path. And the second one is about the Three Characteristics. But I remember when we were studying the Buddha's work, we said before the Four Noble Truths, one has to understand the Three Characteristics.
Yeah.
So obviously one can skip the stage and go to Four Noble Truths first, and then attend the stream entry. After that, yeah, the stream entry to arahatship, then one works on the three characteristics.
That's a very good point. Okay, this is the way I would understand it. I would say that the faculties of these five disciples were probably very mature, so that as soon as they heard the Four Noble Truths, then they were able to have an immediate breakthrough to the first level of enlightenment. But in their case, then, to progress further, they would have to contemplate to and understand the three characteristics. That becomes the means for completely releasing the mind from the defilements. In other words, for reaching arhatship. But within the normal sequence of meditative development, one would begin, I mean, not at the very beginning, but one would proceed through contemplation of the three characteristics, and then there's the contemplation of the three characteristics that leads to insight knowledge. It's called vipassana jnana, the knowledge or wisdom of insight. And it's when the knowledge of insight reaches its fulfillment, its culmination, that it brings the breakthrough to the supramundane realization, which is the realization of the Four Noble Truths. But there are cases of some people who, with very mature faculties, would be able to make that initial breakthrough simply by getting the fundamental principle of the Four Noble Truths. For example, there's a story that comes, it's actually preserved in the Vinaya Pitaka, about the first realization of Sariputta, when he and his friend Moggallana, they had traveled, they were boyhood friends, then when they renounced, they always traveled together throughout India, seeking a teacher who could guide them to enlightenment. And then finally they saw one of these first five arahats, the monk named Asaji. And the first one to see him was Sariputta. Sariputta was very impressed by him. He went to him, asked them, "Who is your teacher?" and so on. Asaji said, "My teacher is the sage Gotama from the Sakyan clan, the one they call the Buddha." Then Sariputta said, "What is his teaching? Tell me the teaching." Then Asaji said, "The teaching is very difficult, very deep. I'm just a beginner, I don't know it very well." But Sariputta said, "Just tell me the essence." And then Asaji just spoke a verse with four lines: "Whatever dhammas there are that arise from a cause, the Tathagata has spoken the cause, and also their cessation. That's what the great sage teaches." And when Sariputta heard that, that was enough for him to make that breakthrough. So his, you know, his faculties were ripe enough.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah.
Even if the Buddha's three teachers were reborn in the formless realm, then couldn't the Buddha use his mind to communicate?
Yeah, this I don't know. Apparently not, because it's taken to be one of sort of like the fundamental principle. It's stated several times in the canon that there are two conditions for the arising of right view, which is understood in the sense of the supramundane right view. One is the wise reflection, and the other is the utterance of another person. Except for those who become fully enlightened Buddhas and the Pacheka Buddhas, they are able to get that supramundane right view just through wise reflection. But all others have to hear the utterance of another, a statement from another person. So if they don't have the ear faculty, if they don't have physical bodies, they don't have the ear, so they can't hear anything from another. Whether they can become Pacheka Buddhas there, I don't know. And in any case, suppose the Buddha gave his first teaching by mind-to-mind communication to the beings in the formless realm, and then this were to be set down in the Buddhist tradition, would be a bit weird. You know, so it's much more cogent, more reasonable to keep it going at the human level, to keep the transmission, the first transmission at the human level.
But then, those that are in formless realm, how do they achieve?
Excuse me?
Those that are in the formless realm, how do they achieve full liberation if they're not able to?
Well, as long as they're in the formless realm, they're not able to achieve it, to achieve even the first stage of understanding. They have to pass away from that realm and then come back into a lower realm in which one has the faculty of hearing. This is why it's said that there are 8 unsuitable conditions for taking rebirth. And then one of those conditions, I mean, some of them are like rebirth in the 3 lower realms, the hell realms, the animal realm, the realm of the afflicted spirits. Then another one is to be reborn in what's called the realm of the long-lived deities. And that is taken to refer to the formless realm. Because in the formless realm, one doesn't have the opportunity to hear the Dhamma and to gain understanding. But somebody who has been, this is what it said, that somebody who is a human being and achieves any of the lower stages of enlightenment can then go on to achieve the formless jhanas, then they can be reborn in the formless realm. But because they already have the right understanding, that understanding remains with them when they take rebirth in the formless realm. And so, even though now they're without bodies, but they have the wisdom, the insight, the understanding to be able to cultivate in that realm, and then they could reach even arhatship, full liberation, in that realm itself. But if they don't have that initial understanding, that initial insight, when they take rebirth in the formless realm, then there's no opportunity to gain it within that realm itself. Yeah, please. Wait, please take the microphone. Okay.
Yeah. Inform, and then if they don't understand the Buddhist, the Dharma teaching, how do they become the informed wrong?
How do they become?
Yeah, what do you call it?
How do they come into the formless realm?
Yes.
Oh, the meditations to achieve the rebirth in the formless realms don't depend on the Buddha's teaching. Those were meditations that were existing in India before the Buddha appeared on the scene. So these are just the meditations which lead to very, very deep samadhi, tranquility, unshakable equanimity. And so those who achieve these meditations sometimes take that attainment to be liberation. And so they don't seek anything further, they don't seek insight, wisdom, understanding. But there's, according to the Buddha, there's a subtle clinging that underlies that very peaceful, calm, equanimous state of the formless meditations. And so in order to eliminate that subtle clinging, one needs insight, wisdom. Any further questions? Okay, then let us go on and finish the sutta. Okay, now we have to remember that how the sutta began. The sutta began when a group of monks, apparently they were visiting from some other place, they came and they wanted to hear a discourse from the Buddha. And so Ananda suggested that the Buddha go to a particular hermitage where these monks were staying, and then the Buddha began giving them this discourse about the noble quest, and then he went into the biographical story, or autobiographical story, about his own quest for enlightenment. So now the Buddha is going to come back to the actual training of these monks, and he's going to speak about what are called the five cords, or five objects of sensual pleasure. So what are these five forms cognizable by the eye, sounds, odors, tastes, tangibles, cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire, provocative of lust. Okay, now the Buddha is going to speak about different ascetics, Brahmins and ascetics. Okay, so he says, there are some recluses and Brahmins who are tied to these five cords of sensual pleasure, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them. Maybe I think now I render this, who are addicted to them, who are obsessed with them. And they use them without seeing the danger in them or understanding the escape from them. Okay, of them it may be understood they have met with calamity, met with disaster, and the evil one, that's Mara, may do with them as he likes. Then the Buddha illustrates this with a simile. Okay, there is a deer in the forest that comes across a heap of snares laid out by a hunter. And then the deer, suppose a forest deer who is bound. Okay, the forest deer is bound or caught, and he lays down on a heap of snares. So it might be understood of this deer, he is met with calamity, met with disaster. The hunter can do with him as he likes. And when the hunter comes, he's caught, trapped. He cannot go where he wants. And so this is like those ascetics and Brahmins who are tied to the five cords of sensual pleasures and use them without seeing the danger in them. Okay, now comes a statement, I think it could be a little bit misunderstood. Okay, it speaks about ascetics and Brahmins who are not tied to the five cords of sensual pleasure, who are not infatuated with them or addicted to them, and who use them seeing the danger and understanding the escape from them. It might be suggesting, or one might interpret this to mean that certain ascetics and Brahmins can fully indulge in sensual pleasures, a little bit like the tantric practitioners, and as long as you understand the danger in them and you use them aware of the escape from them, then you're not trapped by them. But I don't think that's the intention. I don't think the Buddha is giving a discourse on tantric practice here. But rather, I think he's speaking with regard to the basic requisites that monks would be using. Because lay people would come to the monasteries and they would offer the monks sometimes very delicious food and sometimes build not luxurious dwellings, but sometimes well-equipped, well-appointed cottages for them. and the monks might get, they call it medicinal, I think, medicine for the sick, besachaparikaram, gilana pachya besachaparikaram, requisites for the sick and medicinal of provisions, but it can consist of a mixture of honey, molasses, butter, and ghee. So it's quite sumptuous. They serve this in the Buddhist countries, the Theravada Buddhist countries. I never really liked it very much. It's too sweet for me, and it's heavy on the stomach. But I know some monks who just use this in abundance, and then they can swell up quite a bit from using it excessively, and then you get all sorts of health problems. It's called medicine, but you get diabetes, heart condition, overweight. Okay, so I think that is probably what is intended by these five chords of sense pleasure. Okay, so then the Buddha illustrates this with a forest deer who is not bound, unbound, and he lies down on a heap of snares. So it might be understood that this deer has not met with calamity, not met with disaster. The hunter cannot do with him as he likes. And when the hunter comes, the deer can get up and go away. And so that's like the ascetics and Brahmins who are not tied to the five cords of sensual pleasure. Okay, so this would be illustrating a disciple, the way I would understand it, disciples who still have sensual desire within them. They're not yet free from sensual desire. And of course they have to make use of these basic supports of life, which would include, can include delicious food, maybe well-prepared robes, well-appointed dwelling places, delicious refreshments, and so on. So they're not free from the sensual desire, but they use these requisites with wise reflection, with yoniso manasikara, or with yoniso patisankha, reflecting wisely, and with sense restraint, seeing the danger in attachment to them. And so in this way, they are like the deer that are not caught by the traps. Okay, then the third case is illustrated by, suppose there is a deer wandering in the forest, wild, it's not caught by the trap at all. So it walks confidently, stands confidently, sits confidently, lies down confidently. Why is that? Because it is out of the hunter's range. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to show how the monk practices to achieve arhatship. So I'm not going to go into a detailed explanation of the jhanas. So he secluded from sense pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. He enters and dwells in the first jhana. This monk is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one, to deprive Mara's eye of its opportunity. Or I think a better rendering would be to have gone outside the range of Mara's vision. And the commentary gives an important explanation here, because ordinarily a practitioner who just practices the mundane jhana is not beyond Mara's range. Mara could still trap him through the attachment to the jhana, that subtle attachment. But rather the sense here is that this practitioner is going to be using the jhana as a basis for insight in order to cut off the defilements. So that is what makes that jhana a means to blindfold Mara and to get outside his range of vision. Okay, same thing, the second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Then one goes into the formless meditations. There also, the Buddha incorporates them. He also incorporates them into the structure of his path. So one goes beyond all perceptions of form, enters and dwells in the base of infinite space, base of infinite consciousness, base of nothingness, base of neither perception nor non-perception. So these were the same meditations that the Buddha had practiced under his early teachers. But now these meditations, unlike the way they were presented by his early teachers, these meditations have now been embedded within the Buddhist path. So they have to be used as a means or a basis for developing insight. Okay, so now in paragraph 41, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So the same way, this monk is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one by going outside Mara's range of vision. He's not yet escaped from Mara, but in this state, using it as a basis for liberation, Mara cannot see him. Okay, but now 42, again by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, the monk enters and dwells in the cessation of perception and feeling. Okay, this is a special meditative attainment that is unique to the Buddha's teaching. And it lies beyond the stage of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, and then his taints or his defilements are destroyed by seeing with wisdom, through insight wisdom. And this monk is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to Mara, to have gone outside the range of Mara's vision, and he has crossed beyond attachment to the world. And so the Buddha says, just like the deer that's deep in the forest, far away from the places where the hunters go and set their traps, he walks confidently, he stands confidently, he sits confidently, he lies down confidently. Why is that? Because he is out of the evil one's range. And that is the end of the sutta. Okay, so I'll ask for questions. Okay, Richard.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand two things about Mara.
Yeah, please take the
one. He shows up on the last day before Buddha's enlightenment.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And now, if that point, isn't he wanting? Does it, if there's a Buddha has no threat from him, of course he's gone way past that, but he's just on the verge of the cessation of perception and feeling in 42, right?
Yeah.
And so he's at 41, moving into 42. What I want to know is, how does Mara find him? Secondly, if the reason I asked you earlier whether it was Mara's retaliation that Kalama and such died at that moment, were you saying that would be, that, I mean, it wasn't mentioned in here, but I was thinking, well, that might have been inferred somehow. That is, could that not have happened because Allah Kalama was invisible to Anna also?
I'm not sure, actually. Because, you know, I don't think one should take everything in the text so too literally.
Yeah.
One has to see how the text is using a certain concept. And so it seems to be using the concept of being trapped by Mara,
yeah,
generally within the context of those practicing within the framework of the Buddha's teaching.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, the reason I'm trying to understand it is because it has some analogy to, you know, the temptations of the devil in the,
yeah,
in the New Testament.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out, what's the relationship between this evil figure, Mara,
yeah,
and the Christian figure, the devil?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it seems like in Christianity, in Christian tradition, right, the devil gets one last shot. Like, he says, you know, he gives three temptations. He says,
yeah,
well, you know, you can jump down from this building, you can rule the world, and
yeah,
so on. And there's something analogous going on,
yeah,
with Mara. Right? Mara shows up at the end, and one of the things he tempts the Buddha with is delights in sexuality.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's all kinds of maidens with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure the relationship between these two sets of temptations and what trying to understand what kind of creature Mara
yeah
is supposed to be and why he appears at that moment. What he's actually doing and what that represents psychologically.
Yeah, the text, the sutta texts don't try to put together these different aspects of Mara in any kind of systematic way, but the way that Mara comes to be explained in the commentaries, drawing upon different passages, so that they work out a scheme, I think it's five Maras. Let's see, there's the Mara of the defilements, Mara of karmic formations, Mara of the five aggregates, Mara as death, and Mara as a particular deity. It's a sort of obstructive deity. Okay, so certain passages we could see Mara as being understood symbolically as a personification of defilements in the mind. And then other passages speak about Mara as Machu Raja, which means the king of death. So Mara here is just almost like a symbol for death. In fact, the word Mara means literally the killer. It's based on the noun Marana, which is death. And Marati is to die, Marati is to kill. So Mara is the killer. So in that way, Mara is a symbol for the whole of samsara, the round of birth and death, which is driven by Mara as defilements. And then the defilements, what makes death possible, is the arising of the five aggregates to which we become attached through the defilements. So that's Mara as the defilements. That's Mara as the five aggregates. But then Mara appears to the Buddha after his enlightenment several times in some suttas and tries to, for example, to persuade him not to go out and to teach the Dhamma after his enlightenment. Several times Mara tries to entice the Buddha with sensual pleasures after his enlightenment, but he doesn't succeed. So I think on this basis, the compilers had to conclude that Mara can't be just a projection of the Buddha's own sensual desire, because the Buddha is not supposed to have any sensual desire. So Mara must be a deity existing independently. But this is an important difference between Mara and the devil, at least in popular Christianity. Mara doesn't have any connection with hell in Buddhism. And Mara's job is not to lead beings to temptation, to do real evil deeds that they get reborn in hell. Mara is completely happy if people enjoy a pleasant, happy, agreeable life in the sensual world. He wants them to be happy and to enjoy sense pleasures. What he doesn't want is for them to escape from his grip, which means to gain liberation.
So yep. Two small questions. One, I missed the second version of Mara. You said the final one, the final ones, and then I think the third was aggregate.
One of them is karma, karmic activities.
Okay. And last, according to paragraph 42 there, how does Mara find the Buddha after?
After his enlightenment.
After his enlightenment, yeah.
I don't know. He just, in the text, he appears. But of course, the Buddha is not in a deep samadhi on those occasions. The Buddha is engaged in, you know, his day-to-day activities. And so when the Buddha is thinking to send the monks out to preach the Dhamma, then Mara comes to him and says, I still control you, recluse. I still have my grip on your mind. Then the Buddha speaks a rejoinder to Mara and says, you no longer have me, evil one. I'm no longer in your domain, and so on. And then there's occasions when the Buddha is meditating in the wilderness and Mara comes to the Buddha, tries to frighten him by assuming the form of a terrible, ferocious elephant or a lion or a snake. You look in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Mara Samyutta. And then for that question that you're interested in, I remember a scholarly book that I, years ago, it was called maybe Mara and Satin, Satin and Mara. It was published by one of these European publishing companies that published scholarly monographs. I don't remember the name of the author. Okay, let me see the internet. Wow, too many questions. I'll take the internet questions, then we'll go for lunch and then come back and have the discussion period. Oh, today is... do we have the... Oh, the meeting is here. What time?
12.
Excuse me?
12.
12 o'clock. Oh, so we can't have the discussion period today. Sorry. Okay, so let me just take the internet question. Some Buddhist texts state that rebirth as a human is superior. But isn't rebirth as a deity better than human beings, since they can still listen to the Dhamma and carry on conversation with the arahats? I mean, some questions are beyond my capacity to answer. So the texts always extol a human rebirth, because the human life has the opportunity. It has the mixture of both suffering and pleasure or happiness, so that one can enjoy life, but then become disillusioned with pleasure through the experience of suffering. So I can't answer in detail. What are the conditions for rebirth as a deity? Jhana, merit, paramis. Generally, it's said that it requires a fairly, to get reborn in the sense sphere heavens, a fairly high degree in the practice of generosity and the observance of morality, some meditation, but it doesn't have to be very powerful meditation. To be reborn in the Brahma world, the form realm, then one needs the jhanas. To go into the formless realm, one needs the formless meditations. Okay, since the five hindrances are already abandoned before entering the first jhana, what prevents one from going into the higher jhanas after attaining the first? What prevents one from going higher are the coarser jhana factors. Like in the first jhana, it's vitakka and vichara, thought and examination. So that has to be brought to a standstill to go into the second jhana. In the second jhana, it's the piti, the rapture or bliss, that prevents one from going to the third jhana, and so on. Okay, is the cessation of perception and feeling the same as final abandoning of consciousness at page 235? Our time is very short, so I'm just going to have to skip that question and come to an end now. Okay, so we'll end for the day. And there won't be a class next Saturday. The next class will be on June 19th. And then we'll have the class the Saturday after that, June 26th. And these two classes will be taking Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 28. That's the greater discourse on the elephant's footprint simile. So that sutta requires a fair amount of explanation, so it will take two classes. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merit with the devas, the deities, the buddhas, the fear spirits, the nagas, the dragon spirits, and all other beings wishing them to protect the world, to protect the Buddha's teaching, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu mam param. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya bhavagupadhaya vichihitato etantare satakayu papanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pasantu nibutin. Okay, please. Okay, let's see. $3, half dollar.